Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Whatever happened to the Labrador duck? The last credible sighting of this now extinct East Coast seabird was recorded in the 1870s, but that did not stop one self-described nervous and obsessive university professor from launching a global hunt for whatever traces of its existence might remain. Glenn Chilton's search took him to natural history museums and private collections throughout the world and put him in contact with everyone from a Qatari sheikh to the millionaire John DuPont, who Chilton is pretty sure responded to his queries from a hospital for the criminally insane. In the process, Chilton became the world's foremost expert on the ill-fated Labrador duck, even performing some detective work that occasionally resulted in great disappointment for the proud owners of the highly coveted preserved specimens. Glenn Chilton now is an adjunct senior lecturer at James Cook University in Australia. He writes about his adventures in a new book called The Curse of the Labrador Duck, My Obsessive Quest to the Edge of Extinction. Glenn, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
The Labrador duck is a particularly poignant animal to study in that it became extinct within, I guess, about a century of scientists even noting its existence.
Even less than a century. There it was, minding its own business, and less than 100 years after it was discovered, it shuffled off.
Hmm. Were naturalists concerned about its diminishing population while it was still around? Were they aware that it was in trouble?
I think we have to keep in mind that naturalist was kind of a different expression back then. We didn't have the same conservation ethos that we have today. So a couple of authors noted that they weren't as common as they had been, but by the time they wrote, it was just too late for the poor Labrador duck.
So tell us where it hung out.
Right. To the best of our knowledge, it spent its breeding season in northern Canada. Well, Labrador, maybe in northern Quebec, and then it would migrate down the coast past Halifax, past Boston, and wind up around New York City and spend the winter there.
And Labrador is not a particularly welcoming place for any animal.
No, that's right. It's a pretty rough place. I've been there. Not a tree in sight, but lots and lots of ravenous black flies waiting to take your blood.
What did this duck look like?
The drake, the male, was beautiful. It was about the size of a mallard or a scop, and striking black and white, so that one of its common names at the time was skunk duck, for obvious reasons. The females were pretty much like female ducks, gray and brown, so that they could sit on the nests and avoid predators.
And the immature male, I guess, looked very different from the adult.
Yes, it did, and sometimes it's a bit of a trick to tell. To make the distinction between an immature male and a female, it takes a bit of what you described as detective work.
And they ate, what, mostly mollusks?
Yeah. As far as we know, they spent most of their time just off the coast, within sight of the coast, shallow waters, diving for edible mussels, blue mussels are called as well. They'd probably take the occasional crayfish, but most of it was small mollusks.
So it would seem like the fact that they're sort of hanging out and fishing would have made them good hunting targets, but you actually don't think that they were overhunted out of existence.
No. I don't think that's what drove them to extinction. There are very few records of them being shot. Of course, there are specimens in museums that were shot. But back in the time, back in the 19th century, everyone knew how awful they tasted. If you accidentally shot one, brought it to market, put it up on a hook waiting for somebody to buy it, it would rot and fall off the hook before anyone would buy it. So I don't think that's what drove them to extinction. And of course, it's also possible it was a natural extinction, one of those really rare cases where a creature shuffled off without our help. But I don't think so.
It could have been that it was hanging out in dirty water.
Just the wrong place. Hanging around New York, hanging around Long Island, New York, probably didn't do them any good. The human population of that part of the coast was skyrocketing in the late 1800s, and all of the waste from all of those backsides was going straight into the ocean untreated, just where the Labrador duck was trying to spend its winter. I think there's a reasonably good chance, Chris, that they were poisoned into extinction.
Interestingly, John James Audubon did, in fact, see these in the wild and paint them, but as you describe it, and there's a little black and white in the book, it's not a particularly flattering portrait.
No, it's not. It's not often reproduced, not like his Carolina parakeet or his great blue heron that we've all seen. It's still pretty, but I don't know, the drake looks as though he's taking too much cough medicine, and the female looks to just be laughing at him. It's iconic, but it's not pretty.
Do we know anything about their mating habits?
Their mating habits? Not a single thing. Mm-hmm. they passed away so long ago, the records are so poor, we don't even know if they quacked. Presumably they did, but there's no record of them quacking. Sometimes I have to admit that what we don't know about them greatly exceeds what we do know about them.
This is really interesting about Audubon. He wrote later on in life that he had seen nesting grounds, but you're not so sure that that's true.
I'm not so sure. Your listeners will be familiar with his great work, the four-volume double elephant folio of all the birds of North America painted life-size. I mean, it's a tremendous volume. And it came out in about 1843. It came out over a couple of years. But in 1833, 10 years earlier, he was so deep in debt that he hopped in his boat, took north to Labrador, went looking for Labrador ducks, among other things. And when he got to a tiny little community called Blanc Sablon, he sent his son off to shoot things, bring them back to the boat, I'll paint them, you go off and hunt. And his son claims that in Blanc Sablon, on top of low, tangled fir bushes, he saw Labrador duck nests. And it's the only record of Labrador duck nests. And in the 1943 double elephant folio, he writes that in Blanc Sablon, on this particular date, we saw Labrador duck nests. But if you go back to his journals, the writings that he kept on the day, he said, Blanc Sablon, we found no Labrador duck nests. So I'm pretty convinced that, I guess his memory failed him 10 years later.
Yes,
he thought he'd found them, and he really didn't.
You don't think he deliberately lied about this?
He was a good fabricator. He would take a couple of good stories and jam them into one, but I really can't imagine why he would have claimed he saw them when he didn't. I think he misremembered.
So, Glenn, let's step back for a minute and talk about how you got hung up on this particular animal to begin with. It started with the irresistible lure of getting something for almost nothing.
It did. Well, I like to think I'm one of the world's experts on a type of sparrow that will sometimes show up down in California on migration or over winter, the white-crowned sparrow. It's very well known, and I was asked to put together, co-author a short description of everything known about the white-crowned sparrow. It is about 24 pages long. But the editors of the series said, listen, if you write us another account of any bird you like, you get the whole series for free. And free sounded pretty good. I didn't have a lot of money at the time, and $7,000 was a lot worse than free, so I agreed to write a very short account. They said, how about the Labrador duck? I said, perfect. I will write you an account of a bird that went extinct almost before we knew it existed. But then, as these things tend to, it snowballed, and I got carried away.
Yeah, I guess you were assuming that you'd have this done over a long weekend or something.
A long weekend, just scribble down everything that everyone else had written. But I have this terribly, terribly obsessive personality. I just can't let go of things. And so I thought, okay, modest task. I will try to account for every stuffed specimen of Labrador duck, and then I'll leave it at that. But it just kept snowballing and snowballing.
When you started, how many stuffed specimens did you believe existed in the world?
At the time, which is now 15, 14 years ago, there were thought to be 54. And so a modest task to find all of these. But the stories that came out about these 54 ducks, more or less, were so good. People kept saying, you've got to write a book. You've got to write a book about Labrador ducks. And so I said, all right, I will. I'll write a book about Labrador ducks, but I am going to go and examine and measure every stuffed duck in the world. I am going to go and examine every egg that is supposed to have been laid by a Labrador duck. I'm going to go to where they were shot. I'm going to do everything associated with Labrador ducks.
I have to tell you, this sounds like a more expensive proposition than buying yourself a $7,000 set of books.
And in the end, it is. Thank goodness I've got such an understanding wife, as the money was hemorrhaging out of our savings account and trying to stem the flow. She was just so wonderful standing there beside me saying, you've got to go, you've got to go.
And she went with you on some of these excursions, and other times was more than happy for you to even travel with other women.
Well, that's right. I think we both realized early on that if I just traveled alone and then wrote a book, you'd only get my perspective. And if I always took my wife, you'd only get her perspective. I wanted the readers to learn more about these exotic cities I traveled to from the eyes of other travelers. And so I took a wide range of wild characters, often beautiful young women that aren't my wife. Yeah.
Okay, so there are essentially two forms of sort of preserved ducks in the world, be they extinct or not. Most people have seen animals preserved by taxidermy, but there's also something called a study skin. Can you tell us what that is and how it's used?
Yeah, you bet. Taxidermic mounts are wonderful, as a bird would have appeared in life, or a mammal would have appeared in life, but they take up an awful lot of space, and they're vulnerable to damage. And so the great museums of the world tend to make the stuffed birds long and skinny, lying on their backs with their wings pressed to their side. They're not particularly artistic or beautiful, but for a research scientist, they're perfectly adequate. And so some Labrador ducks are taxidermic preparations, and some of them are these long, skinny, torpedo-shaped study skins.
Do they have bones inside?
They have very few bones. Virtually all of the muscles, all of the viscera are taken out. Most of the bones are clipped out, but there are some bones left in the wing and in the skull, just to give them shape.
So what kinds of methods would 19th century taxidermists have used to take an animal corpse and preserve it for the ages?
Well, quite a variety of techniques. One of the most insidious is the use of arsenic to try and protect the skin against pests, because beetles are more than pleased to eat a stuffed duck. Moths are more than pleased. But of course, as we know today, these arsenic-soaked skins are pretty dangerous. And so often I had to wear protective clothing just to examine the ducks. But after that, you'd stuff it full of whatever was handy, straw, wool. If you wanted to make it pretty, you'd put sticks in the inside to give them form, wires, whatever it took. And there are specimens that even now, 150 years later, are truly beautiful specimens.
Yeah, it sounds like some of these guys were really artists, and some of them were just going as fast as they could.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, well, if you're out in the bush trying to stuff ducks by campfire, go as fast as you can. But there was one taxidermist, his name was George Bell, and he lived in New York City, and he was famous for his preparations. Roosevelt used to visit his shop, Audubon used to visit his shop, and his preparations really just are that good.
One of the really interesting mysteries about this animal was the color of its eyes.
Yep, absolutely, because the feathers retain color, other body parts don't necessarily, but you've got to pluck the eyes out when you're making a study skin or a taxidermic mount, because otherwise they rot and stink up the joint, and so the eyes were plucked out, and I was hoping to determine the eye color of the Labrador duck in life by looking at the glass eyes they were put in the taxidermic mounts. I thought maybe the taxidermist will have seen that it had a brown eye and put in a brown glass eye or a yellow eye. Unfortunately, a good chunk of them have brown eyes, the stuffed specimens, that is. A good chunk of them have yellow eyes, and a few of them had ruby red eyes. Some of them had white eyes. Some of them had clear eyes. And so at the end of the day, I don't know what color a Labrador duck's eyes were.
And as you mentioned, there are other parts of, you know, the feathers stay pretty good if they're done correctly,
yeah.
But the beaks and the feet tend to fade over time.
They do tend to fade over time. And to a scientist, that's fine. Let it fade. Tell me what color it was. Write it down. But some of these taxidermists decided they knew better than nature, I suppose, and they paint the bills, the most outrageous colors. Black, fair enough, I can accept black. Sometimes baby blue or navy ship gray, and in the process, they really messed up a lot of these specimens. Trying to see the fine detail under the thick, goopy paint, it doesn't work as well. I wish they just left them alone.
Yeah, you think there's a possibility that sometimes they would just take whatever paint they had left around and mix that up and apply it as opposed to trying to match the original color.
Well, sometimes there's an astonishing correspondence between the color on the wooden base that the duck is sitting on and the color of its bill. I think they just had some paint left over from bathroom renovations and used that.
Glenn Chilton is my guest. He is currently adjunct senior lecturer at James Cook University in Australia. We're talking about his new book, The Curse of the Labrador Duck, My Obsessive Quest to the Edge of Extinction. You can join our conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Glenn Chilton. He is adjunct senior lecturer at James Cook University. His new book is called The Curse of the Labrador Duck, My Obsessive Quest to the Edge of Extinction. You can join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Glenn, how much might a Labrador duck specimen fetch on the open market these days?
That's a very difficult question to answer, Chris. Whatever someone can afford to pay. Over the years, people have paid varying amounts from 500 pounds 50 years ago, so about $1,000 50 years ago, up to many tens of thousands of dollars today. Probably less than you would expect for something as rare as a Labrador duck. But if a great museum found one that came onto the market, they'd be looking at, hard to know, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000.
So one of the rumors that you tried to track down was that the DuPont family had been in possession of one of these specimens.
Absolutely right. This is the duck that gave my book its title, The Curse of the Labrador Duck. It was thought that when it disappeared from England, it may have wound up in the possession of the DuPont family, and in particular John E. DuPont, who had a great interest in things, natural history, who had, helped establish a great museum in New England, and maybe they went to him. And so I got in touch with Mr. DuPont, and he was very polite in writing back to me, saying, no, we don't have your duck. We don't have any Labrador duck eggs. You might try the following institutions. And so I wrote back and said, thank you very much. And then a colleague said, you know, you might want to look up John E. DuPont on the Internet, on some of the websites of news services. And when I did, I found that this gentleman is the richest fellow ever to be convicted of murder in the United States. He, in a fit of insanity, murdered a member of the U.S. Olympic wrestling team in front of the wrestler's wife and was sentenced to a very long time in jail. So I suppose that when he wrote to me thanking me for my inquiries about Labrador ducks, he was writing to me from psychiatric prison.
And I guess he's got the time to correspond with people who are curious about this sort of thing.
Yeah, and he can afford a stamp.
Can you talk for a minute about the eggs? Because one of the things that was really important to you was not simply seeing these things and measuring them all, but you wanted to verify that they were the real thing.
That's right. And it's easy with a stuffed duck. I can look at it and say, yes, that is, or no, that's not a real Labrador duck. But when it comes down to eggs, they have a problem. They're kind of eggy. They look like eggs. And you might guess from its size and its general shape that it's a duck egg, but after that, you just can't look at one and tell. And there were known to be 9 possible Labrador duck eggs in the world. And I traveled to each of these 9 eggs, and using a crazy set of lenses in front of my eyes and dental instruments, I was able to pick out material from inside the egg, ship it off to a colleague of mine at Boston University, Mike Sorensen. He's a geneticist, and he was able to determine whether or not these were real Labrador duck eggs or not.
And they were all fake.
In the end, they were all fake, and that's such a tragedy because the stories associated with these 9 eggs are just amazing. 6 of them were found in Dresden, and they managed to escape the firebombing of Dresden, and they turned out to be fakes. They're, well, if not fakes, not produced by Labrador ducks. They were produced by mergansers. And there was one egg that was collected in the middle 1800s by the assistant surgeon on a ship that was trying to find the Northwest Passage. And, oh, golly, they got into trouble. They were rescued years later from the ice. And he took this egg that he collected, held it for years, took it back to England, and it turned out to be an eider, not particularly valuable at all. So a great loss to humankind. No Labrador duck eggs.
And for people who are wondering, these were all hollowed out because you can't indefinitely preserve an egg with the yolk and the membrane inside.
Well, that's right. At Easter time, when you were a child, you couldn't just paint an egg and put it on the countertop because it would eventually rot and explode. So I don't know, Chris, if you did this, did you poke a hole in either end and then blow out the contents and then you got a shell left?
I've tried it, but mostly I had broken eggshells all over.
I had sore cheeks. I've tried it now as an adult with chicken eggs, and I just keep winding up with sore cheeks. But all the great natural history museums and their egg collections, they're not really eggs, they're egg shells. But there's still genetic material on the inside. There's material goop left over when the hen produced the egg.
Of course, you have scientific credentials and you were working for a long time in the field, but was it difficult to get permission to go and to examine these eggs and then to remove some material from inside?
It was easier for me than it would be for you. Even just seeing a Labrador duck, almost all of them are locked up in safes in cabinets behind the scenes, off display. The public doesn't get to see them. Luckily, having professor in front of my name and doctor in front of my name and being an ornithologist, the door is open to me. But when it came to getting those eggs and, golly, trying to get material from the inside, the curators of the museums were a little more careful about what I was doing. So I'd have to fill out paperwork, what I was going to do, who was going to analyze the results, where it would get published. And then curators, curious curators, because no one had ever tried this before, would stand over my shoulders, one over each shoulder, looking what I was doing, making sure I was going to chip that precious eggshell.
I would think that that sort of pressure would make your hands tremble.
It didn't make my hands tremble, but it did make me sweat. And on occasion, I was afraid I was going to sweat into the material I just collected and ruin it. Luckily, that didn't happen.
Is there anything, Glenn, that could have been learned about the Labrador duck had you been able to get valid DNA from an egg?
Well, any number of things. The egg collections of the world provide us with all sorts of information. For instance, our great awakening to the dangers of DDT came from eggshell collections in the great museums. Hmm. It is possible that if any of those had been Labrador duck eggs, we could have looked for contaminants in it, get the analytical chemists involved. Could we tell anything about what the Labrador duck ate more than we already know? Could we tell whether the environment was contaminated back in the 1800s? Unfortunately, we've lost all that potential. No eggs.
It is not unheard of for, I guess, a taxidermy mount to be sort of fabricated. Can you talk about that?
Oh, dear, yes. On occasion, something will happen to your precious mount. Mice will get at it, or moths will get at it. And the specimen is so beautiful and so valuable, you try to patch it up a bit. And I've found examples of Labrador ducks that were patched up. But unfortunately, I came across one that had gone a little further than that. I was in central Germany, and I hopped on the train from Braunschweig to Halberstadt, a tiny little place. And they've got a big bird collection, but the most valuable thing in their bird collection was their Labrador duck. And they brought it out with great pride and sat it down carefully in front of me, and it wasn't a Labrador duck at all. And I speak a bit of German, but not enough to say this is a fabrication. The curator understood no English at all, so I had to write to him when I got home in German and say, what you've got is a fake. It's a domestic duck, a white domestic duck painted with greasy, tarry paint to more or less resemble a Labrador duck. But the curious part of the whole story is that the beak actually was from a Labrador duck. So I think what happened sometime between 200 and 250 years ago, this museum had a real Labrador duck, and it got attacked by moths or mice or rats or something, and all that was left was the bill. They said, should we throw away the bill? No, it's too valuable. There was back then, and there is today, a pond just down from the museum covered with white domestic ducks. I think somebody went out, shot one, stuffed it, put the bill of the Labrador duck on it, painted the duck more or less black and white, and I was the first person in 200 years who visited the museum who recognized that this was a fake.
Oh, no. How did they respond to that?
The curator was such a gracious man. He said, well, he wrote back to me in German and said, well, it's best to know. So their most prized possession turned out to be a forgery.
Talk about, for a minute, how these things are kept in various institutions, because in some places they seem to be sort of haphazardly preserved.
Yes, and that's one of the problems with natural history museums. Some of them are magnificent. Last night I was at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, and they've got an ornithological collection, of course, and it's magnificent. The American Museum of Natural History in New York, the Smithsonian in Washington, the Gallery of Evolution in Paris, they're magnificent institutions that have wonderful cabinets, humidity-controlled, temperature-controlled, no pests anywhere in sight, and these specimens are going to last at least 500 years before they eventually fall apart on their own. But there are natural history museums, particularly in Europe, very old ones, that have fallen out of favor. The people who control the purse strings in the city don't see them as valuable anymore, which I think is a terrible crime. But when they don't see them as valuable, you don't keep up with the pest control, and you don't keep up with the latest advances in how to keep these magnificent, irreplaceable specimens intact. And so some of them are getting a bit ratty.
What's the difference, besides their sort of care of the collection, between a really effective natural history museum and one that just doesn't work?
Right. Beyond their care, to me, one of the most important things about a natural history museum, it has its science collection, it brings in new material when it can, but it's public education. It's making sure that these specimens are available to teach all of us, but particularly children, about the wonders of biodiversity, but also the great tragedy of loss of biodiversity. You can't always have a lot of extinct things on display, because just exposure to light will eventually damage them beyond repair. But if on occasion you have a special exhibition of extinct things, let me give you a great example, Chris. I was at the Field Museum in Chicago, and I was standing in front of a display, a public display of extinct birds, and there was a Carolina parakeet in it. And if your listeners know a Carolina parakeet, they're going, ah, right now, because they're so beautiful. They were so beautiful before we drove them to extinction. Yellow and blue and green and red, and a family walked up to this display cabinet while I was standing there. Mother, father, teenagers, and the teenage girl, maybe 13 years old, bright blue hair, looked at this beautiful Carolina parakeet and said, "Can you imagine being surrounded by a flock of those? That would be awesome." And I just wanted to shake her hand because she got it. She understood what had been taken from her. None of us will ever stand in amongst a flock of Carolina parakeets. That has been stolen from her, and that's the power of a natural history museum.
Do you think that people are paying enough attention to the plight of animals that are threatened right now?
I hope that there are enough naturalists, enough conservation biologists making enough of a fuss. I think most people would agree that we're moving into a different era in terms of conservation, environmentalism, conservation biology, that we're doing our best, but we're losing things at such a great rate it's almost hard to keep up. I don't know how we get more people interested, more people involved, unless it's education of children. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the great environmental revolution of the 70s, where we said, we're going to stop polluting the air, we're going to stop polluting the water. And largely as a result of the children's reaction, we did. And I'm hoping, pardon me for just a moment, I'm hoping that we're going to continue that with children of this generation and get them involved.
When you were a child, you tell a funny story about getting hooked on caffeine at around the same time you were getting hooked on science.
Oh, yes. Well, my heritage is British. And my parents were determined to keep that British heritage alive, even though we lived in Canada and I was born in Canada. And so they would feed me bucket loads of tea. And Red Rose Tea, at the time, was putting out little trading cards, little cardboard rectangles. And on some years, it would be, oh, the trees of North America, or North American Indians, or it would be adventures in space. But in 1970, it was North American wildlife in peril. And the number one card that year was the Labrador duck. And part of me thinks that maybe that's what got me hooked on Labrador ducks all those years later.
And it says something about you that somewhere in your basement or somewhere, you still have those trading cards.
I've still got it, and I dug it out to make sure I've still got it, and there it is. I've still got 1970, all those years ago, nearly 40 years ago, I've still got that card.
I don't know if you know them by number so well, but I wonder if you can talk about duck number 12, which was looted by the Russian army.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Chris, as I said, some of these specimens have astounding stories to go along with them. There was a duck, and before the Second World War, it was known to have been in Dresden. And it had been there so long, no one really knew where it came from, North America somewhere, but exactly who collected it, under what circumstances, we didn't know. But there it is, a hen, beautiful brown and gray Labrador duck, housed safely in Dresden. But you and I know what happened to Dresden during the war. It got firebombed. It got leveled, with the death of tens of thousands of people, and many assumed that the duck went with it. But it didn't, because every time that part of Germany went to war, they would pack up all the great paintings, all of the great Caravaggios and Titians and Rubens, and they'd pack them on a ship, take them upriver to a small community called Königstein, and then they'd take them uphill to the fortress Königstein, a tremendous fortress, and there the paintings and my duck would remain. And then the war would come to an end, and back would go all the paintings and my duck back down river to Dresden. But at the end of the Second World War, the duck didn't come back to Dresden because the Russian army marched in to the fortress, opened the vaults and said, wow, we're going to take that painting, we're going to take that painting, we're going to take that painting, and we're going to take that duck. And so my duck made it back to Russia, or off to Russia, stolen from the Germans, and it made it to Leningrad, now St. Petersburg. And the Russians admitted that they'd stolen the paintings and gave them back. It took until the 1970s for them to admit that they had stolen the duck from the fortress Königstein and eventually gave it back to Dresden. And so I went to Dresden, and there it sits.
Did you have a favorite one that you found? I mean, I know a lot of them, at some point, they have to look sort of similar one to the next.
Oh, they don't. Not to me. Not to an obsessive character who's draining his bank account to see them all. No, they were all special. The first one I saw was at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto, and it took my breath away, and it turned out to be the most beautiful specimen in the world. When I got to my very last duck, I opened up the box it was in, and again, my breath was taken away. Have I got a favorite one? No, I don't think so. I feel a special affinity for all of them. Now, keep in mind, I'm the only person in the world who has ever seen or will ever see every single specimen. Somehow, they're mine.
Yeah, you point out that 12 people have been to the moon, but you're the only one to achieve this feat.
Yeah, or will ever try. Hopefully, humans will go back to the moon. No one's ever going to try and look at all those ducks again.
Did you photograph every single one?
I photographed every single one. And my publishers made me put together a website, and to my cringing embarrassment, it's called glennchilton.com. But on that website is a photograph of every stuffed Labrador duck in the world.
Glenn Chilton is my guest. You can find more about his work at glennchilton.com. We will resume our conversation in just a moment. We're talking about his book, The Curse of the Labrador Duck, My Obsessive Quest to the Edge of Extinction. If you want to join us, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Glenn Chilton. He is adjunct senior lecturer at James Cook University in Australia. His new book is called The Curse of the Labrador Duck, My Obsessive Quest to the Edge of Extinction. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org. Jumping species a little bit here, Glenn, one of the things you did when you were in, I guess, Paris was take the opportunity to observe up close and personal a taxidermic mount of a great auk. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Well, many of the museums that are good enough to have a Labrador duck are also good enough to have an extinct great auk. And they're pretty special, too. They're tall. They're the original penguins. And so anytime I got to have a look at a great auk, I took the opportunity to snap a couple of photographs. Even if sometimes the overzealous curators insisted on taking them out of cabinets where they'd rested for 100 years, at risking breaking them and putting them down in my lap, I got to see quite a few. Great auks, Carolina parakeets, some extinct Hawaiian birds. It was quite a treat.
It must have been an interesting trip, given that I would imagine, and I've read, that on more than one occasion, what you met on these trips were kindred spirits, people who cared as much about these things as you did, that didn't often find someone who showed that level of interest in their collection.
At times, you've got to feel a bit sorry for the curators of these collections and museums. Working in rooms without windows, often without recognition, keeping these valuable specimens valuable, keeping them in good nick, collecting more and building them up. But they don't get to see the people out in the galleries. But when somebody like me walks in, who's got this obsession, this passion for exactly what they're doing, I'm the kind of guy they wait to see. I'm the kind of guy they want to walk in through their front door.
And they are valuable enough to somebody that they've been stolen a couple times that you know of.
Yes. Over the last century and a half, a number of specimens have gone missing. A lot of those went missing in the Second World War in Europe because of bombing by one side or the other. But yes, even stolen. The American Museum of Natural History put together a wonderful display, a wonderful diorama in the late 1800s with five Labrador ducks in it. But at one point, they needed to do some work to the ducts behind the display, and somebody left the panel unlocked, and somebody walked in and, boink, pulled the Labrador duck out of its display, and it's never been recovered.
On the other hand, reports that you heard that they'd been sold in garage sales turned out not to be the case.
Oh, my goodness. I came across a book about endangered and extinct North American birds claiming that recently a Labrador duck was found and sold at a garage sale. And you can imagine how upset I was that somebody found something as valuable as a Labrador duck at a garage sale. It took me ever such a long time to track down this story, try to find the roots of the story. And in the end, there never was a garage sale duck. It was a duck that had been at Ann Arbor in Michigan, and it had not come from a garage sale, luckily for me.
How do you organize your notes, and how did you organize your notes on this multi-year quest?
Oh, my goodness, yeah. Knowing that I was writing a book, and the book is about Labrador ducks, but it's also about travel and my obsession and the mischief that I got into. So every day I'd have a little coil-bound notebook in my pocket and jot down notes. Then I'd get to the museum and pull out the hard copy of the book that I kept my notes in, longhand, pencil on paper. And then come the evening, I'd find a pub somewhere, a good pub with good beer, and sit down for sometimes 2, sometimes 3 hours and redo the notes so that when I went back to them a year or 2 years later, they'd still be in good shape and I could still use them. In fact, I'm still hoping that if, I don't know, somebody steals a duck 20 years from now, and I'm called in to serve as evidence, they'll be able to say, are you sure that's the same duck you saw in Belgium 20 years ago? And I'll be able to say, yep, I've got good notes.
Do you actually have this fantasy that this will happen?
Well, you spend a lot of time in hotel rooms and a lot of times looking at ducks, all sorts of things enter your mind.
We have an email here from Kelly in Dallas who asks, what is your opinion on the status of the ivory-billed woodpecker in the southern U.S.? Are the reports credible?
There's a good question. Thank you for that, Kelly. Many of us ornithologists, many of us who belong to the union of AOU, American Ornithologists Union, believe that the reports of the ivory-billed woodpecker resurfacing were probably premature, that maybe there should have been sober second thought before going to the press and getting it published. Given that so little supporting evidence has come forward since those early reports, I'm going to step out on a limb and say that most ornithologists believe that it was extinct, it is still extinct, and that the reports on its resurfacing are premature. Now, perhaps it was a bit premature because the world loves a rediscovered species. Anytime anything is rediscovered, thought to be extinct, and brought back from that extinction, it's on the front page of every newspaper in the world. I think we're feeling good about ourselves. Maybe we haven't messed up the environment quite as badly as we thought we had. Ivory-billed woodpecker, sadly, still gone.
When those reports first started to come out, was there a part of you that held out some hope that there might be a Labrador duck somewhere?
Well, since the Labrador ducks all spent their winter around New York City, and there's an awful lot of bird watchers and an awful lot of other eyes around that part of the coast,
sure,
no one has reliably reported one since 1875. I live in hope, but I'm also realistic.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to William in Dallas. Hi, William.
Yes, hello. I wanted to ask, has there been any work on maybe cloning the material that they got, or if they got the material, if the material they do have, if it could be cloned?
William, thank you for that question. It is a great question. Maybe I should have even put it in my book, and I'm ashamed that I didn't. You know, we all think about Jurassic Park and the way that we managed to reconstruct dinosaurs, or the scientists were supposed to have reconstructed dinosaurs from the DNA. And there is DNA in the stuffed specimens. Unfortunately, it's terribly, terribly fragmented. Is it possible to do that today, using technologies available today? Absolutely not. Is it possible that in 30 or 40 or 50 years from now, we'll have the technology to recreate a Labrador duck from these fragments of DNA? Quite possibly. But then I have to wonder, will we? Because reconstructing enough Labrador ducks would be a terribly costly venture. And when I look at the world of conservation today, there are a lot of species that could be saved for a small fraction of that, and we still don't put the money into conserving them. Also, I wonder if we did put together 5 or 6 Labrador ducks from these museum specimens and whiz-bang technology, whether there'd be enough genetic variability in those 5 or 6 ducks that they could continue to survive, or would they be so terribly inbred that their reconstruction would be a very short-term thing. So I'm an optimist, but again, I'm a realist.
Beyond the resources required to do it that potentially could be better spent preserving species that are still alive and endangered, are there ethical questions about things like cloning an extinct animal to the same extent that people have really serious ethical issues over the cloning of human tissue?
I have no reservation about attempts to reconstruct extinct species other than the cost that could be better spent to wiping out introduced species, saving seabirds from rats, that sort of thing. If we could reconstruct some of these and put them back into their original habitats, they'd be filling an ecological role. They would be filling the role that they filled before they went extinct. It could be a very good thing. Who knows? I may be cold in the ground when we start getting some of these back, but I also think about the tremendous benefit we'd get from being surrounded by a flock of Carolina parakeets or get to see migrations of millions of passenger pigeons. It's an exciting thought to me.
John in Fort Worth is our next caller. Hello, John.
Hi. When I was a child, I'm 56 years old right now, I remember hearing of a book that had a great impact called Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. And it seems like the author here is the kind of individual that could stir up feelings like that again. Could he comment?
What a wonderful thing for you to say, John. I was also inspired by that book by Rachel Carson. Silent Spring, the notion that if we don't start cleaning up our act, if we don't stop polluting the environment, it is possible that a spring in the future will have no songbirds in it. There'll be a silent spring. I wrote my book because I thought it was fun. I was having fun adventures, and I'm hoping people will read it on the surface because it's fun. But I hope there's that underlying message. John, that poor Labrador duck slipped away almost unnoticed. And to this day, species are slipping away almost without us noticing them. And I'm hoping that someone, particularly children, will pick up that message and say, this has got to stop. You are robbing me and my children, my grandchildren, the opportunity to see these wonderful creatures. My fingers are crossed that that message will come through in part from my books, from my writings.
How far do people have to travel from a place like Dallas to see a good specimen of a Labrador duck?
Right. There are very few on public display, unfortunately. The closest ones would be at the Smithsonian in Washington, but none of those are on display. So if someone in Texas wants to see one, well, unfortunately, the closest one will be in Philadelphia. There are 2 on display there, and then there are the 4 in New York City that haven't been stolen yet.
Speaking of that, we should say that you make a promise or an offer at the end of your book of $10,000 if someone can show you another specimen that you haven't yet examined.
Absolutely. I'm this terribly obsessive personality, and I believe I've seen them all. And people said, you know what's going to happen. Your book is going to be on the shelf for 10 minutes. You're going to claim to have seen everyone. Someone will find another one. I said, that's not going to happen. Put your money where your mouth is. So I've done that. I have put up a reward described at the back of my book, $10,000 for anyone who can bring me to a legitimate stuffed Labrador duck that I haven't described in the book. They don't have to give me the duck. They just have to take me to it and show it to me.
Are these Canadian dollars, Australian dollars, American dollars?
They are American dollars. I checked and it came up to $10,686 Canadian.
Okay, so it's worth making the transition.
Absolutely.
What do you think... Are there people who have been following this bird before you brought it up, or do you think that no one would know anything about it if you had not undertaken this project?
I think that North Americans know a lot about some extinct species. Passenger pigeons, people know about those. Great auks, quite a few people know about great auks, but before I came along, for reasons that are unknown to me, the poor old Labrador duck got very, very little interest. But even knowing that the book was coming out, it has stirred the imagination. I'm getting email messages and letters almost weekly from wood carvers, duck carvers, who are trying to create wooden Labrador ducks and want to know my opinion. Is the shape right? Does it feel right? Are the colors correct? So maybe the Labrador duck is due to come out of obscurity and catch on, as it were.
Can you tell us a little bit about seeing your very last Labrador duck? Because this was literally sort of an international incident.
It was. This poor duck was discovered in England in the late 1940s. It was offered to the National Museum in England for £500. They turned it down. The duck was purchased by an insane millionaire. On and on the story goes until it was finally, oh boy, good story, until it was eventually purchased by a sheikh in the Middle East. Now, how am I supposed to get a hold of a sheikh in the Middle East? He doesn't care about me, and he doesn't care about my book. But the book was about examining every specimen. Luckily, the sheikh had the duck returned to England so it could get some permits. And I got a telephone call one afternoon. Glenn, if you can be in London, England, tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, if you can be at Heathrow Airport, you get to see this duck. If you're not going to be there, the duck will go back to the Middle East, and you will never, ever see it ever again as long as you live. So my sweet, sweet, dear, understanding wife leapt to the computer, booked me a flight to London Heathrow, and I flew there, and I got to examine my last duck. And as I said before, it gave me the same rush to see the last one as it did to see the first one, even though it meant that exploration, that journey was at an end.
Did she book you the ticket and say, that's it, Glenn, we're not spending another penny on this?
She's agreed to the $10,000 reward.
Have you had any calls, any emails to that effect?
Yeah, since the book came out a couple of weeks ago. I'm in North America right now. My wife is monitoring my email back in Australia with all her other duties as a professor. She's keeping up with it. And she said, you've had a couple of email messages along the lines of, my grandfather claims to have a couple of them in his attic. And that's as far as it's gone so far. By the time my tour ends and I get back to Australia, there might be quite a stack of them. But if people think they've got one, I've had no solid bites yet. People in Texas, go and look in your grandmother's attic for a beautiful black and white duck. It's worth $10,000.
If you had to take a guess, how many do you think might be out there somewhere, whether or not you ever see them?
I'm hoping zero. I'd like the $10,000 to remain in my pocket, but I'm hoping that there are others. That part of me says, how much more can we learn by another specimen, another two or three specimens that we don't know about the Labrador duck? Most of these have no information attached to them, but if we could find one and we knew where it was shot, when it was shot, it might provide us additional material for analyzing analytical techniques and DNA analysis. There's all sorts of possibilities.
Glenn Chilton is adjunct senior lecturer at James Cook University. His new book is called The Curse of the Labrador Duck, My Obsessive Quest to the Edge of Extinction. Glenn, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.